from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum in the Hour Ahead, Grammy-winning singer, songwriter, and author Roseanne Cash joins us in the studio.
The feather's not a bird, the rain is not the sea, the stone is not a mountain, but a river runs through me.
Roseanne Cash's latest album, The River and the Thread, was inspired by her travels through the South to raise money for the restoration of her father Johnny Cash's childhood home. We'll talk to her about the new album, her career, and her upcoming series of shows at SF Jazz. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
Dark highways and the country roads don't scare you like they did. The woods and winds now welcome you to the places you once hid.
And Roseanne Cash joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. You heard her track Long Way Home, or you're hearing it underneath here. She was born in Memphis, actually, the daughter of famed singer Johnny Cash, but raised in Southern California. And after a trip through the South with her musician-composer husband John Leventhal to raise money for the restoration of her father's childhood home in Arkansas, she and her husband put out her first album since 2008 release of Black Cadillac. The River and the Thread debuted in mid-January high up on Billboard's album chart and reached number one on Amazon's bestseller list, and the 11-time Grammy Award nominee and Grammy winner joins us for this morning's second hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, you sort of went home again, didn't you?
Whatever that means, right? Some kind of home you carry inside yourself. It wasn't just the restoration of my dad's boyhood home, but for several reasons, we were taking these trips down south and open-hearted in a way that we hadn't been before. And it was a perfect storm of inspiring events that we started writing these songs from. That, going to Arkansas, and one other thing is I had a friend in Florence, Alabama.
And was this a woman to talk about sewing?
Yes, and she taught me to sew. She's Natalie Chan, and she stitches these beautiful handmade clothes. And she taught me to sew, and she said, you know, you have to love the thread. And as a songwriter, that was like, bing, it just
and
stuck in my head.
The River and the Thread.
The river,
of course,
and the thread.
Is the Mississippi,
right.
The grand river of them all. Well, it sounded like, I mean, you had different odysseys. Your husband was interested in, you're both interested in Faulkner, but he was interested in Dylan, perhaps.
Yeah.
You were more interested in your roots, I think, weren't you?
Well, I think every roots musician owes something to the Delta. I mean, we definitely owe something to the Delta. So to go through those areas where Howlin' Wolf and Charlie Patton and B.B. King and all of these guys sat on the front porch of pop staples, of juke joints, and played music, you know, and picked cotton during the day, that's a compelling picture. And then John is a Faulkner. He wrote his college thesis on Faulkner, so we went to Faulkner's house, and we went to the Tallahatchie Bridge and all of these places that loomed large.
That's where the picture is, in fact.
Yes.
And, of course, you think Bobby Joe McAllister and
Billy Joe McAllister.
Billy Joe McAllister. Bobby
Gentry.
You're thinking
of Bobby Gentry, right?
Yeah. I mean, but there's also Emmett Till. I mean, both of those sort of were invading your consciousness. You know?
All of it. Robert Johnson's grave is right down the road from Money, Mississippi, where 14-year-old Emmett Till was murdered, and an event which sparked the Civil Rights Movement. And right around the corner from that is the Tallahatchie Bridge. So these three places, you could walk between them. It was just mind-boggling.
Well, you reminded me of an interview I did years ago with Carlos Fuentes where he said Bill Clinton was in a conversation and knew a lot more about Faulkner than he ever would have imagined. But there's, again, the Southern connection. And what I was struck by was reading about a conversation you had with former President Clinton where he said it was a baby that was thrown off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
Well, a lot of people think that.
I thought that.
I always thought that, too.
Yeah.
That's so funny, though. President Clinton was in the audience one night when I performed. It was this big, fancy benefit for the Rainforest Foundation at Carnegie Hall. And I sang Ode to Billy Joe in the show, and President Clinton summoned me at intermission to talk about that song. And he waxed poetic for 15 minutes about that song and what it represented and the psychological shame of the South. And it was mind-blowing. I said, do you have no more space in your brain? You can talk about this song? Aren't you supposed to be saving the world or something?
Because he was president at the time. Let me put on an academic hat for just a moment here, because when we talk about Faulkner in the South, I think about probably the best book that's been written, in my judgment, about the South, which is by someone named Cash, W.J. Cash, The Mind of the South.
You know? I know that piece. Was that a book or a long essay?
It's a book,
essay?
Yeah. It's a psychohistory is what he calls
right.
it. And, you know, it's fascinating.
When I first read that, I tried to find out if we were related, and I couldn't trace it back, but surely we are somewhere.
Well, it's an extraordinary book, and it brings to mind a lot of things. Well, you know, you talk about in your new album, it's just your Southern heart. I mean, the idea of a Southern heart. He has a kind of idea of a Southern mind and the heart against itself, to use a Faulkner description from his Nobel Prize about what literature, great literature is. It's the heart against itself.
I have to read this again. I didn't retain that much, but it's fascinating because he talks about those things that are peculiarly Southern and how insular it can be in the South. And that somewhat in this record, too, is looking out from the South and through the prism of what it feels like to be Southern. Even though I don't really consider myself to be Southern, I was born in Memphis. You know, I lived in the South on and off a decade. Both my parents are Southern. My grandparents were cotton farmers in Arkansas, and that runs deep to me. You know, my connections there are powerful.
But this new album, and we're going to hear a little bit of it coming up now, Modern Blue, this is the album's actually first single, Modern Blue. The sense of the South is palpable. I mean, you know, I know you identified more with the Beach Boys and the Beatles.
Not the Beach Boys. I was a Beatles girl.
Well, a Beatles
My
girl.
My husband had this argument all the time, by the way.
But you like Joni Mitchell, you like Buffalo Springfield,
exactly.
Those kind of groups, not necessarily the Appalachian fiddle type of music.
That's
or
right.
The Delta blues. Let's hear a little bit of this Modern Blue. Ah, yes, I think that's again from the new album by Roseanne Cash, and that album, The River and the Thread, that's the cut Modern Blue. You talk about the strength and the sadness from the gumbo soil. I mean, that's really what this album seems to epitomize in so many ways for me. But I was thinking about the work that you had so strongly been identified with. You were talking about this as a new front for you in some ways. I mean, because a lot of these songs are third person, and so much of your earlier work was almost confessional in many ways. It was private. It was interior.
Yeah, introspective, definitely. That was John. You know, the first song we wrote on the album, was called Etta's Tune. And from that moment, he said, write more third person. I wrote all the lyrics. He wrote all the music. And he has a vast palette in Southern roots music, you know, so it was such a pleasure to write lyrics for what he was exploring. But he kept saying, write more third person, write outside yourself, you know, and every time I would fall into any navel gazing at all, he would push me again. And it was great. I'd always wanted to write third person ballads and third person narratives in general. So that song, however, Modern Blue, that's really our story, traveling the world, keeping our head down and eyes on each other to keep the course steady.
But working together and working together well for the most part.
Yeah, right? Well for the most part. I mean, we've taken some time to learn how to do it properly.
Actually, I was reading about, you have almost in some ways maybe a good paradigm for people who've been through divorces, because you've got an ex-husband who many people know of from his work. And I think, how does John introduce your ex-husband? As his husband-in-law? Husband-in-law, yeah.
It's very evolved, isn't it?
But your kids also are very involved in music. I mean, you got a daughter who, I guess, is she married this guitarist yet? Or is she going to marry him? And then you got another kid who's almost like a musical genius.
Yeah. All of my kids are musical. It's the one who's going to marry the guitarist, though, she's kind of a domestic goddess. She's a cook and she's an events planner and she's all kinds of things. And then one daughter is a songwriter and a musician and a prose writer. And my son, he's 15, I don't know what he's going to do, but he's incredibly musical.
When you used to be identified so strongly as Johnny Cash's daughter, I mean, now you are pretty much in your own orbit, in your own cosmos, and I use those metaphors decidedly because I know of your interest in theoretical physics. But was it an ambivalent thing for you through the years? I mean, you know, growing up maybe in his sunshine as well as his shadow?
Oh, that's a lovely way to put it. Never quite heard it like that. Sure. I mean, every young person in their 20s wants to get away from their parents and find out who they are. And I was going into a field that I had a very successful parent, and it was daunting. And I probably pushed away a little harder than I had to, or maybe a little longer than I had to. But I really wanted to be recognized for my own work. And he did cast a long shadow and a lot of sun, as you say.
He also gave you a list, and you still have it, don't
you?
Yeah,
a list of what he thought were 100 essential songs.
I was interested, though, to see some of that list. For example, 500 Miles, which became famous because of Peter, Paul, and Mary. It's always, in my mind, some ways been more of a folk song, but the roots go way back beyond that.
Yeah, you would be surprised how many what you would call folk songs were on that. I mean, and ultimately, I think my dad considered himself a folk artist. It was an umbrella that covered, you know, rockabilly and hillbilly and country and those narrative ballads that he was so good at writing and performing.
What about all this identification with Johnny Cash? I mean, a lot of it with the Man in Black, with prisons, with with drugs. I mean, a lot of it, in fact, stirred up by that movie with Joaquin Phoenix. It's been kind of ongoing, hasn't it? And you've even talked about crazy people who think that they're tuned into your father somehow.
Yeah, you know, channel his opinions to me to tell me I'm doing something wrong. It's a form of insanity. Yes, he does. I mean, you know, Michael, I don't get involved in my dad's posthumous career. I just don't. My dad's last record happened before he died, in my opinion. I know that that's not fair, and there are still some things in the vault that are worthwhile and should be out there, and I don't begrudge that at all. But as far as the industry of iconization, I'm not interested. This thing about helping restore his boyhood home, that was powerful to me. My dad was very proud of where he came from.
It was a WPA home, wasn't it?
It was. It was created in the New Deal, 500 cottages. And that's a poor area of Arkansas. To draw attention to that area was great, and also to show my kids what their lineage was.
Did you ask Clinton for money? He got Arkansas roots.
It's a good idea. Still trying to get to him. Maybe I could use this song that he loves as an in.
Talking to Roseanne Cash, singer, songwriter, actually author as well. It has a volume of stories out. And we just had Lori Moore on. I'm sure you know her work.
Yeah.
We were talking about Nashville, and she decided to move from Madison, took a professorship at Vanderbilt, and said, well, people seem to be people wherever you go, but Nashville people are, I think, different than, well, say, New Yorkers and Midwesterners or Southern Californians. It's a very different culture, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's great that there are different cultural personalities around the country, that it's not just an endless mall of the same kind of people.
Let's, by the way, tell listeners that you're performing at the SF Jazz Center tonight, as well as through Saturday and Sunday. Although it's a sellout, they can still get a hold of your album and still avail themselves of the pleasure of listening to this new work of yours. And speaking of new work, I was reading an article you did about how devastating the earnings have been because of streaming, because of Spotify, for musicians, especially for new musicians. And you're going to testify before Congress on this?
Yeah, I was supposed to go on December 3rd, but because of the shutdown before that, everything got pushed back. So that's upcoming. You know, streaming services are difficult and damaging for songwriters and musicians, but piracy is still the number one offender. And search engines will send you to pirate sites on the first page. So that's not helpful, to say the very least. And the royalties that I think people think will go to musicians from streaming services, subscription services, don't. It just doesn't happen. I mean, my own example is I got my Spotify earnings for a year and a half, and for 577,000 streams, I got $104. And that's pretty typical. That's pretty typical from every musician I know.
Well, you said in the 50s, Willie Nelson made $500 for Nightlife, and it's gone completely in a circle.
Right. He sold the song Nightlife, which became American standard, for $500 because he was broke. The guy he sold it to went on to make millions and millions, and Willie never got anything but the $500. So these things were formed, organizations, to protect songwriters from that happening again.
Or from all those black artists, too, particularly.
Exactly,
who were ripped off.
Exactly, you know? But we are back in basically the same state.
Well, and you love vinyl.
I do love vinyl. We sell my record on vinyl. And my kids like vinyl. It's fascinating. I'm thinking, this is fantastic. People are listening to albums again. You know, when we were sequencing this record, The River and the Thread, I was obsessing about the sequence. We did 40 sequences. And I tweeted something like, why am I obsessing about this? Nobody cares about sequence anymore. It's all on shuffle, or they listen to a single track. And I started getting hundreds of responses. I care. I care about sequencing. I care.
That's heartening.
It was heartening.
Talk about your tweeting. Didn't you tweet it as Jane Austen from the Super Bowl?
I did. Jane Austen at the Super Bowl.
I love that.
One does not have the pleasure of understanding the purpose of the game. That's how she started.
Yeah, but how do you assume the persona of Jane Austen?
Because I'm kind of steeped in her. Yeah, I've read and reread and reread her.
Which says a lot about you. That mostly, actually... Speaking of saying a lot about you, when we were talking about the shift to more third person and everything, I thought maybe we'd hear an earlier cut. And this is one of the more personal cuts, I guess. It goes back to 1981. It was a big breakout hit. This is 7 Year Ache. Let's hear it. I'm just interested in finding out what it's like in terms of the impact of hearing work that goes back that far, 3 decades.
Listening to my voice.
You were 23 years old.
I was 23. It's like listening to my daughter's voice. I was just thinking, gosh, she was so young. And how did she do that? How did she write that song? She didn't know what she was doing. I have a tenderness for that, like it's not me anymore.
It's a former avatar or incarnation.
A former incarnation.
Speaking about your voice, I mean, I really like your voice immensely, but I know you've struggled with polyps and things. Yeah. Is that all behind you now?
Well, one would hope. I've lost my voice twice. I take really good care of it now. So hyper aware that the human voice has a shelf life as far as singing. I mean, there are anomalies. Tony Bennett still singing, you know. Ella sang late into her life, but it has a shelf life, and that's why I'm enjoying every moment of it right now.
Well, we had an interview recently with Linda Ronstadt, and you know, there's a heartbreaking story of her with Parkinson's, but her courage and her fortitude and her attitude, I mean, are just extraordinary.
You know, last time I know Linda, and the last time I played San Francisco Jazz a few years ago, I asked her to sit in with me and do a song with me, and she said, no, I don't do that anymore. And this is before the announcement about Parkinson's came out. And I was like a little irritated with her, like, Linda, you got one of the greatest voices in the world. Why are you not doing this anymore? And then I heard the announcement and it just broke my heart.
Yeah. She's amazing, though. You also went through brain surgery. Yeah.
I did. How's my brain?
You've had some
today?
Ordeals. I don't know. Mine's atrophying every day, but
I'm good.
You're sharp. It's good to talk to you.
It was a rare congenital malformation that got worse over time, called Chiari malformation, and it was a brutal surgery. It took me a while to recover, but I'm doing really well.
Good. And, you know, I was reading an article Ron Rosenbaum did about you, and he said the song you sang with your father, September When It Comes, I'm just quoting him now, once you hear it, you will never recover as long as you live.
Ron.
I mean, this is what any songwriter would dream of here. And Ron Rosenbaum, by the way, is a top drawer writer.
He really is. Yeah. I love his work on Shakespeare. You know, The Shakespeare Wars is one of my favorite books about the whole Shakespeare franchise.
Who wrote Shakespeare?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, he's a strict Stratfordian, you know, but he's very scholar. Anyway, I love it. I love that he loves Shakespeare as much as he loves, you know, pop music. Fascinating guy.
He's a versatile guy, yeah. And you're quite the versatile woman with your interest in theoretical physics, getting into dialogue with Brian Greene, who has had a number of appearances on this show, and asking him, maybe those multiverses or those parallel universes, is that what God is?
I asked him if the unified field was God.
Oh, it was a unified field.
Yeah,
right.
Field God. And he paused, and then he said, well, it depends on your definition of God. He turned it right back.
It's a perfect answer. Again, we're talking with Roseanne Cash, singer, songwriter, eldest daughter of country music legend Johnny Cash, and she will be performing at SF Jazz Center, unfortunately all sold out, but you're going to be doing mainly from these new tracks? Or?
Well, we're doing something I've wanted to do my whole life, which is to perform an album in sequence live. And it's,
because of all those letters you got saying they still like sequence.
Yes, exactly. It becomes of a piece. It's like a theater piece. There's a narrative to it. It unfolds. I just love doing that. And then we break and do some of my older songs.
So it's going to be a potpourri, in other words. But
a potpourri.
But the sequence will be the first part of it.
That's right.
How strong do you identify with jazz?
I'm a bit of a jazz Luddite. There are maybe four records that I know and love, you know, Miles and a little bit of Monk.
Quite a difference.
Right. Not much. I'm a Luddite, as I said.
So when we talk of the new album, we're really talking about, well, Memphis rockabilly and guitar picking from, all that Southern kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the record really delves in, as John says, it nods but not bow. It doesn't bow to the Delta blues, to country pop, country soul, a little bit of Appalachian, but more swampy, you know, like Creedence meets Bobby Gentry.
Good description. We're going to go into our break with Night School, and we're also going to invite listeners to join us if you have something you'd like to say to Roseanne Cash, if you have a question or a comment, or just want to join this conversation. We welcome your involvement. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, join us in conversation, 866-733-6786, or let us know your thoughts by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. If you want to tweet as Jane Austen or just as yourself, you can tweet us as well. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum.
And all I see is you in night school. In night school.
This is Forum. We're spending this hour with Roseanne Cash, 11 times nominated for Grammy Awards and actually recipient of Grammy Awards as well. And she's performing at SF Jazz Center tonight as well as through Saturday and Sunday, although can't get a ticket, or maybe, I don't know, maybe a black market ticket. I'm not advocating that, but who knows? You can also join us in conversation, and any questions or comments you might have, you're welcome to participate in this program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. You can also post anything onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Twitter handles at KQED Forum. And I said to Roseanne off the air that when we played Cut from Modern Blue, I should have mentioned that it may be the only track extant from any artist that has both Memphis and Barcelona, or Barcelona, as they say, those who are natives, in the same song. Also, I want to go to our callers and emailers, but before we do, we've been talking a lot about poetry
right.
off the air, and you are obviously under the influence and a very serious reader of poets.
I am. Certain poets. I don't think my breadth of knowledge is nearly what yours is, but I do have certain poets I go back to over and over. And I have a friend who sends me a poem every morning by email, which is fascinating.
That's what Garrison Keillor used to do. You know, have a poem every morning. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But who do you like? You like Mary Oliver.
I like Mary Oliver. I love Seamus Heaney. I love Rumi, you know, mystic poets. And Natasha Trethewey, I've just gotten into her. I think she's fantastic. Who else were we just talking about?
Oh, we were talking about Larkin, and I know you like
Larkin.
Philip Larkin.
Yeah. Yeah, Larkin is so dark, but that one poem we were speaking of—
which we can't refer to on air because it has expletives in it that are impermissible. your mom and dad, they blank you up is sort of how it begins. Let's begin with some of our callers, and we go first to Bill. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I love Rumi also.
Oh.
I got turned on to you by seeing the video you did with Carl Perkins Rockabilly back in the 80s and been buying your stuff ever since. But I wondered, of the friends of your parents, who are the people who became really friends of yours versus friends of your parents who knew you? And kind of what was the, you know, the attraction that kind of followed you through those generations? And I'll listen to it on the radio. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for the call.
Thank you. Well, Carl Perkins definitely was, he was like my uncle. I adored him.
First blue suede shoes, before Elvis even.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, Waylon Jennings and Kris Kristofferson, even though they weren't as old as my, or Chris was not as old as my dad. He was more like a big brother, and he still is, by the way. I love him to death.
Can you tell me something about Kris Kristofferson? He comes from San Mateo. You know, he was born and raised out here, but he always sounded country. I mean, it was kind of odd in some ways because he was born and raised right in here in the Bay Area.
Right, but through Texas. By way of Texas, he made his way to Nashville and then back to L.A. He lives in Hawaii now. He's not in great health right now, so I think he's going to retire soon. But, you know, his body of work as a songwriter, it's unparalleled in American music. Not really answering this gentleman's question, but those three gents were important in my life.
Busted Flat in Baton Rouge.
Waiting for a train.
Yeah. Let me get to another caller. And we go next to Santa Clara. Martin, join us. Hi.
Great. Hey, thanks for taking the call, Roseanne. Just great work, beautiful voice over all these years. Question, well, actually, you made a comment about vinyl, and there's a movie called Warm Bodies about zombies. And the zombie likes vinyl, listening to songs on vinyl, and he says because they're more alive. And I really think that's true about vinyl. It's more alive. But my question is, given that your career has spanned decades now, do you find the music industry pressuring or the studios pressuring artists to use more things like auto-tune or injecting overlay tracks and things like that where you feel like it's not my music anymore? How do you feel about that? I'll take my answer, you know, on the radio. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Thank you. I don't find that the executives are entering into the studio to tell us what to do. That may be the case for other people. It wasn't for us. They came in and checked in and listened and were encouraging. Don was is my boss. He's the head of Blue Note, the label I'm on, and we've been friends for a long time, and he's a musician himself, so I don't think that he would interfere in that process. Of course, they said things like, well, this sounds like it'd be great for radio or things like that, but as far as production, they would have never done that. I'm, like I said, I don't know what happens with other people, but for me, that never happened.
But boy, the technology has just moved so quickly. I mean, I think about you doing songs in 1981 as opposed to where we are now, where quantum leaps ahead.
The entire technology has changed. I've seen it change in my lifetime. I mean, this is when I made 7 Year 8, the song you played earlier, that album, we mastered it 3 days after John Lennon was killed. And I went to the studio, the mastering lab, with the engineer, and I had him cut into the mother vinyl in the run-out groove, Goodbye John. So the first 25,000 albums pressed have Goodbye John in the run-out groove. And every time someone brings the vinyl for me to sign at a concert, I pull it out to see if it's one of the first pressing. And a guy just had one the other night. It's always so exciting to see that. But anyway, that technology, you go to the mastering lab, they cut it like that. You know, when Pro Tools came in, the learning curve was too steep for me. I couldn't follow.
Let me bring another caller on in this conversation. That's Lou. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Yeah, good morning. First of all, I'm a recording engineer and producer, and I want to compliment you on going and talking about the Spotify and all the other downloading stuff. And the interesting comment that you made about people doing vinyl, the reason why they're doing vinyl again is because all of those downloading systems and iPods and MP3 players, they all use this terrible thing that destroys the quality of the recordings. We put a lot of money into recording in the studio, and then they put it through these things that have this throwaway compression that just destroys the absolute parts of the music itself. That's why Neil Young has been doing his Pono thing, is to try to bring back quality into music instead of quantity. It appears that quantity had become the thing to do instead of quality, and now I'm seeing a lot of artists wanting to get back and actually get the quality of their music back.
This is such an interesting conversation to me, and I wrote a memoir and I wrote a chapter about that, you know, how it was before and what's happened about recording. And, you know, it's kind of specific and geeky, and I don't know if everybody enjoys this conversation. But I agree with you. The algorithm that music goes through, the delivery system on, you know, that it goes through on the internet or when you're downloading stuff, it does squeeze the life out of it in some ways. And vinyl is interesting, although most vinyl, it's, you know, it's still mastered digitally and then just dumped onto vinyl. But there are a few people who are recording analog again. I haven't done it again myself in a long time.
Let me thank you, Lou, for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to go back. I'm just thinking about Unified Field and God for a moment, because there's a cut on this new album, If Jesus Came from Mississippi, and Jesus was so important to your father. God was so important to your father. It may be a little bit of an irreverent question to ask, but how important is religion in your life?
I'm not religious, or at least I'm not traditionally religious. God to me is the source of art and music and small children. That it's a vast thing that I don't think my mind has the ability to comprehend. I don't see a personalized God, or I don't follow a dogma. I mean, in truth, I think Buddhism makes the most sense because it's compassion, self-awareness, nonviolence, and I figure, what else do you need besides those three things?
This is a track, actually, that I want listeners to hear. World of Strange Design.
Other things you'll find won't fit your old ideas. They're aligning shifting sands. You walk across a ghostly bridge to a crumbling promised land. If Jesus came from Mississippi, if tears began to rise, I guess I'll start at the beginning. It's a world of strange design.
Yeah, we wanted to bring in that song apropos to the discussion we were talking about, World of Strange Design, with your love of poetry. Strong recommendation, maybe reading a sonnet by Robert Frost. You know, we associate him with swinging birches and walks in the woods and everything, but it's an extraordinary poem called Design, about essentially a spider destroying a fly, and I'm sorry, a spider destroying... What's he doing? On a heal-all flower of all flowers named, trapping this prey, this insect, and destroying it, and then saying, you know, almost seems as if there's a designer, it's all happening very much in a constructed way, in a way that's mechanical by design. But then he says, like quantum mechanics, he brings it at the end, says, if design govern in things so small, and you're just
all right, I will look that up as soon as I leave.
Well, I know you're intrigued by those things.
I am, very much.
And I just want to, speaking about things that you're intrigued by, I just want to ask you about something that you said on a couple of occasions that I was really struck by, and that is, it's important to remember about the ordinariness of life by things like finding out where a post office is or buying a new refrigerator. I was curious about those metaphors, you know, that you want to sort of put this in perspective in terms of what we just have to do on an ordinary day-to-day basis.
Well, yeah, I was not a person who was very tethered to the earth before I met John Leventhal, my husband. And he taught me about those things, you know, to live in the world. Here's where you go buy stamps. Here, you know, let's buy a refrigerator. Here's how you handle money, you know, those real world things. And it's actually given me a lot of joy to find in normalcy. It gives me a lot of joy. And I really thank him for that. And, you know, in the same time, I brought a kind of more airiness to his life, which is the greatest thing about marriage, is that you can bring those parts of yourself and feed each other. But I also, I lost that thread, the way you started the question. But that's enough, right?
The joy in the ordinary.
That's
a very important point to make, especially
for
a musician.
Exactly. That, you know, musicians and artists have more than their fair share of mental illness and drug addiction. And that I think it's partly is that your raw material you're working with is inside yourself. And it's seductive to just stay in there. But it's healthy to come back in the world and know where the post office is.
Yeah, I've experienced that in terms of just taking out the trash, you know.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, because it's almost ritualistic. It has to be done, and, you know, it's pro forma, I guess, as somebody would maybe be apt to describe it, but it takes me out of my cerebrality or, you know.
There you go.
Whatever. Bella asks, I love hearing all the topics that Miss Cash is interested in. It sounds as if she stays open to inspiration from any source. Can you ask her about her creative process? As someone who does a lot of writing, reading, and art making, I'm curious how she structures her workday to keep the creative inspiration coming and how it turns into projects.
I'm not a very structured person, and that's a great question, by the way. I'd like to know her work process. I'm always interested in that. I mean, I am serious about my work, and she's right. I try to stay open to inspiration from all areas and all sources. You never know when you'll get something for free, but you don't get it all for free. You know, it's like my friend Stephen Pressfield, who's a great writer. He wrote The Legend of Bagger Vance. He says, you have to show the muse you're serious. Keep, you know, just show up for work. So I try to show up for work in all of the perverse little ways that means for me.
Just heard a story recently on the air here from one of our guests talking about Tom Waits being inspired while he was driving.
Oh, yeah.
You know that story?
It's a great story.
He wanted to write it down, and he was driving. Why do you do this now, you know, basically?
Don't you see I'm driving?
Here's Jennifer, who asked this question on Facebook. Has Miss Cash read Elizabeth Talent's Nobody's a Mystery that mentions a Roseanne Cash song?
Oh, I have not, but I remember getting a request to use that lyric. That's interesting. I'm glad she reminded me about that. I wonder if the book is good. I'd love to read it. Who knows?
Well,
she knows.
You'll find out.
Yeah.
Paul asks or says, I perceive Texas music and Southern music to be different. Even if Texas is ostensibly part of the South, what's Roseanne's point of view?
Yeah, it's very different. The whole swing, Bob Wills, or, you know, even though Willie and the good old boy cowboy outlaw thing. That's very different than the Delta blues. Mm-hmm. But, oh, man, there are sources of inspiration all across that belt, aren't there? All the way to Appalachia.
Exactly. Here's a listener from Oakland who says, her album Black Cadillac is one of the most important records I have ever experienced. I lost my father right when that record came out. I happened to be lucky enough to help sell it since I work for her distributor, EMI, and that record helped heal my loss. Mm. I hope it helped heal hers, too. Thank you for the very personal work. Also, thank you for your work with Alison Gilbert. The audiobook with your story is wonderful.
Mm.
Stephen writes, please.
It's an honor, by the way. Thank you.
please, please, three pleases. Please, please, please ask Miss Cash if she would publish the complete list of songs that her father created for her. There are a lot of folks, including me, and I'm mostly a jazz and klezmer guy, who would value Johnny's perspective, identifying the songs that serve as the basic foundation of American music. Please publish the list, Roseanne.
Someday I will. There's so much about my father that's been co-opted for the public, you know, that this is a precious thing he gave me that I just want to hang on for myself a while longer.
It's his legacy. It's his personal legacy handed to you.
Yeah,
right?
It is.
Jerry says, thank you for your music and your performance. My wife and I have been to your performances in Nicasio and love them.
Thank you.
And we'll bring on another caller. And that's you, Thomas, from up in Sonoma County. Hi.
Hi. When I was a kid, I remember seeing Johnny Cash performing on TV at some kind of an event in Washington, and President Nixon was there, and I think it was like an outdoor thing, and I always had liked Johnny Cash and his music, but at that concert, he sang a song that was honoring protest singers, and it had some kind of a line in it, like they're just trying to tell the truth or find the truth or something. And the camera cut to Nixon, and Nixon's expression went from a fake smile to a very genuine scowl.
To his normal scowl, yeah.
And that changed my opinion of Johnny Cash. From then on, I just love the guy. So do you know what song that was?
Yeah, that song was called What Is Truth.
What is Truth? And what was that performance? Do you remember
it? I was a kid then. I mean, it could have just been a White House performance where they ask artists to come, and I don't know. I was probably a young teenager at that time.
Right. Well, maybe we're close to the same age. Well, thank you very much. That's
sure.
been a long quest to figure out what the heck was that song.
What is Truth?
What is Truth? Okay, thank you for all your great music, and it's fun listening to you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas, for the call. What do we know about your dad's politics, and did they affect you politically, or...?
I hesitate to say this because everyone co-opts him right and left, and I made a decision not to use him in that way, but he was almost Quaker in his pacifism. Mm-hmm. He didn't think there was ever any reason to go to war, and yet, he went and played for the troops in Vietnam. You know, that's the kind of person he could hold two opposing thoughts at the same time, which very few people seem to be able to do these days.
I always remember that line from Folsom, the Folsom Prison live recording that was done of his work, where he says, "I shot a man in Reno just to see him die."
Yeah, I know. But do you believe that Anthony Hopkins was what in Silence of the Lambs, that that's who he was? It's acting.
Of course it's acting. Let me get another caller on here. And here's Donna from Santa Clara. Hi.
Hi. Leslie, I want to ask Roseanne, I just loved when Natalie Cole sang songs that duets with her father, and I wonder if you have ever done that, Roseanne.
Well, we mentioned September When It Comes. You
yeah, when he was alive, I did a duet with him called September When It Comes. It's on my album Rules of Travel.
And thank you, Donna, for the call. You kind of smiled when she mentioned Natalie Cole because, again, there's that same sense in her life, although I believe she was adopted, I think.
Oh, I don't know.
I think so, but let me bring another caller on here, and that's Chris. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, I'm hearing some arrogance and ignorance here from Roseanne Cash. You know, when she talks about doesn't know how to buy a refrigerator, where to get stamps, and she's all concerned about her music getting ripped off, you know, money and all this. I mean, for 20, 30 years, it was the artists colluding with the record labels and radio to get their music out. And when LPs went to CDs, the price was supposed to come down, and it went up. And you had albums with maybe one or two cuts that people wanted to hear, and they had to spend $7.99, $8.99. I never hear Don Henley or any of these artists, so-called artists, talking about how they ripped off the consumer for 30 years. So I will steal music left and right. I won't resell it, but I'll certainly steal it with no guilt whatsoever. And it's just, you know, she's born with a silver spoon, you know, and doesn't have to think about money until she meets whatever husband it was, you know, and then she's all worried about her getting ripped off. What about
the consumers get ripped off for 30 years.
Roseanne Cash.
Have you listened to my records? Am I ripping you off? I mean, do you understand the royalty systems that artists have with record labels? We don't make all the money. And would you steal an apple from a grocery store? Probably not, but you don't have any compunction about stealing the work that someone put into creating a song. We're not even getting reimbursed for the production of the song, much less the value of the song anymore.
Let me thank the caller. That was a little bit out of the blue. You don't usually hear those kinds of responses.
It's okay. It's fine. he feels how he feels.
He feels how he feels. Well said. There is a lot of attention that this new album has received, however. I mean, probably more than any of your previous work.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? At my age, I feel so lucky that, you know, some of these songs, I feel like I wrote them in 6 months plus 35 years, you know, that I've been working this long to write songs that I feel are the best I've written and that John feels are the best that we've written. And we didn't know how it would be received, and we put it out, and people are really responding to it and saying it's my best work, and that is so satisfying because, again, I know there's a shelf life that at some point I'll be arrogantly just buying a refrigerator.
Well, it is the most successful album of your career. I'm looking at the stats now. Number 11 overall Billboard charts, number 2 Billboard Country, and number 1 Amazon.
Yeah, it's doing well. I'm proud.
More in the South. Likely, yeah.
I think that you guys in New York and major cities are, although, you know, we just played this show in the South in Oxford, Mississippi, and Meridian, Mississippi, and Lafayette, Louisiana. People, I think they are enjoying being recognized in that way, both musically and geographically. The song, there's so much geography in this record, you know, and you point out Florence, Alabama, and say, there's this great art community in Florence, Alabama, and people are proud that somebody recognizes it.
Since your husband was so enamored of Faulkner to do a thesis on him, I have just a quick anecdote to tell you about Faulkner in Oxford, Mississippi. One of my mentors was Walter Tevis, a name that some people recognize. He was the author of The Hustler and The Man Who Fell to the Earth and a lot of other work that he has not received, in my judgment, appropriate recognition for. But the fact of the matter is he's driving in Oxford and he thinks, I could actually see William Faulkner, who was his idol, you know, because Faulkner was alive at that time.
Wow.
It's a true story. And he's thinking, well, it's Sunday, blue laws, the bars are closed, so I'm not going to be able to see Faulkner, and you know, because he's probably likely to be in the bar.
Right, he's likely to be in the bar. Right.
So he's driving, and he's having these thoughts and reflections, and Walter is a completely credible character. You can't make up stories like this. Suddenly, he's musing, and somebody walks in front of his car, and he almost hits the guy, and the guy slams down on his car, you know.
I know where this is going.
You know where it's going. It was William Faulkner. He was absolutely incontrovertibly sure.
Do you know, when we were down on one of these trips, we met this gentleman in his 90s, Lee McCarty, who had been friends with Faulkner. And I when I was talking to him, I realized he's 90. He's lived in this area of Mississippi his whole life. And I said, Lee, did you know William Faulkner? He said, oh, Bill was a lovely person.
Well, he was, and yet he wasn't. I've always had that story in my head. There was a PBS special done about Faulkner and his daughter, his only living child. You know the anecdote she told about she wanted to talk to him. He was holed up with his liquor and writing and so forth. And he said to her, Shakespeare's daughter is not remembered, you know.
Oh, that's
it's about
tough.
As staggeringly cruel as it gets.
Yeah.
Let me get to the caller on here, though. I still love his work. Peter, hi, you're on.
Oh, hi. Roseanne, I'm a big fan of yours. I love especially the sound of your voice. I think there's just so much feeling in it. And, of course, you know, your father as well.
Thank you.
And wondering how you feel about the film, Walk the Line, and especially how the I mean, I'm a big fan of Joaquin Phoenix, too, and just how the music was done there. Of course, the actors sang the songs. Mm-hmm. And just your response to that.
Well, she said before she's kind of removed herself from the iconization of her father. But what about the music and the way that was portrayed?
Well, I should answer first by saying that I really like the movie Ray about Ray Charles, but I bet if you talk to his kids, they would say, well, that's not really how it was for me. And also, you can't compress the life of an artist into 2 hours. It's not possible. I did have an objection about not using my dad's original music, but letting the actor sing. But that's just personal. And T-Bone Burnett's a friend of mine, and he did the soundtrack, and I thought he did a great job. The movie was too much, you know, Silver Spoon notwithstanding. My father was a drug addict in those years, and it was painful to watch. And when the movie came out, I actually left the country so I wouldn't be around all the hubbub about it. And it was particularly painful to my mother, who actually died right before it came out. You know, the whole thing was just not great for my family. But I took my 14-year-old daughter to a screening. They were nice enough to do that, to send it and say, you can take your family. And at the end of the film, my 14-year-old daughter said, well, Mom, that was a good movie. And I realized she had no reference to it. Therefore, it was fine. And realized it was for other people.
How about your kids and the legend of Johnny Cash, though? I mean, how have they grown up into that?
It's particularly hard for my daughter, who's a songwriter. You know, she can never get away from it. She's got two generations of musicians, you know, well-known musicians, and an icon grandfather in back of her. But my son is so far removed, because he was four when my dad died, that he enjoys it. You know, I took him to Sun Studios. This is where Grandpa made his first records. He was, like, curious. He picked up a guitar, interested in the microphones, you know. I said, do you know this song of your grandpa's? Yeah, I know that one. So it's removed.
Well, good to have you with us. Thank you so much for being with us.
Such a pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
The album is The River and the Thread. We're going out with a different song. This is Money Road. It's a nice bookend to all this conversation about the South. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.